So really, this is in some sense a discussion session. And so I thought before I started the discussion and showed you some interesting data, I'd put down the questions that I'd like to cover here. And really, if there's to be a motivation for this, it's to say that I suppose as condensed matter physicists, we live in the era of the ascendancy of two dimensions. Because we have the quantum Hall effect, we've learned about states being localized in two dimensions. We have these beautiful, almost two-dimensional high-temperature superconductors. We have conformal field theory. And it's very tempting to ascribe new phenomena to two-dimensionality. So tempting, indeed, that in heavy fermion phenomena, you can have a system that's got an almost completely isotropic conductivity, and then you can read papers which will describe it as a quasi-two-dimensional system. So, now, the other flip side to this coin is whether we can learn anything about two-dimensional high-temperature superconductors by looking at higher-dimensional systems. And this is a very serious question, and there's quite a body of data which actually gives one pause for thought. And so what I'm going to do this afternoon is pose the questions and show you a little bit of the data. That's all I'm going to do. Okay? And if anyone wants to discuss some of the theoretical questions that underpin it, I'm happy to go to the blackboard, and that's what I'll do. Okay. So that's the first question. Are the observed anomalies in the cuprates a uniquely 2D phenomenon, or do they have three-dimensional analogs? And so to answer this, to some extent, we have to go back and look at three-dimensional systems.
Yes. What constitutes a uniquely two-dimensional phenomenon?
Well, I think that, no, I'm not, of course not. But I am in the following sense, that what I will discuss is how the standard model, which I'll define, the model of spin fluctuations interacting with the Fermi surface, there's good reason to suppose that, for example, its unusual behavior begins in two dimensions and downwards. And therefore, unusual behavior wouldn't be expected in three dimensions. So it could be a dimensionality issue. It could be that the upper critical dimension, for example, were less than three for the quantum critical behavior. It could conceivably be a topological issue, for example, that certain types of topological excitations exist in two dimensions which don't have a 3D counterpart. Contrarywise, if you see similar behavior to two dimensions in three dimensions, you might have pause for thought to wonder whether you should be formulating a theory which is exclusively two-dimensional. You should be wondering how flexible your theory is, whether two-dimensionality is the critical dimension for your theory, or whether your theory being uniquely topological and relevant to two-dimensionality, whether that theory is indeed the thing that explains similar phenomena in higher dimensions. So it's really posing the question here. It's an exercise. And of course, it would be rather wonderful if there were new phenomena here, new fixed points, which exist both in three dimensions, but exist in an even more aggressive form in two dimensions. And so that's the reason for posing the question. I want to keep it somewhat vague, deliberately.
Is the word systems equivalent to superconductors, or are you going to make...
Well, I think, no, I don't think so, because, of course, high temperature superconductivity is a whole package, right? You have to understand the normal state, the superconducting state. Today, I'm not actually going to discuss superconductivity in higher dimensions. So there are some interesting things. I debated this.
I mean, are these materials all superconducting?
Some of them are, some of them aren't.
You'll tell us which.
Yep. Okay. But I'm going to focus predominantly on normal state properties. Okay. So those are my questions. And these questions come up in the context of a number of higher dimensional systems. I will show you, before the end of the talk, a very nice higher dimensional system, barium vanadium sulfide, which has a second order quantum critical point, which is also a metal insulator transition. And it has some properties reminiscent of the cuprates. I will also talk about a large body of work in heavy fermions, and well, I'm not going to talk a great deal, it's only a half-hour talk, and talk about some of the emerging phenomenology which is developed here, which questions whether the standard model, namely Gaussian critical spin fluctuations coupled to a Fermi surface, actually describes the various, particularly anti-ferromagnetic quantum critical points that are observed in clean three-dimensional systems. Okay. And before I go on, let's go down some of the, let's talk about the standard model, and let's talk about some of its key features. I should also mention before I go on that some of the questions I'm raising here are not uniquely my own. They come out of discussions with many colleagues. Most recently, Chi-Miao Si and Catherine Pepin and I have been discussing some of these questions. So I don't claim them uniquely to be my own. They're just out there. I want to discuss them with people here. Okay. So let's just first talk about the standard model. And I'm going to flick off the projector for a moment and just draw a few things on the thing. So what do we understand by the standard model? And obviously this depends on the field which we're talking about.
That's no global symmetry.
That's no global symmetries. Well, I think the way people understand this is really a model which has a model in which you can basically couple, write the system as a Fermi surface, if you like a Fermi liquid, coupled simply to Gaussian but critical spin fluctuations. And this is really a model which has a long history. In recent times, it's been associated with the names Hertz and Millis, but its history goes back a lot further. You can add Maria to this name and probably quite a few others to the picture. But basically, the idea is you have a Fermi surface in which the electrons interact via a Gaussian spin fluctuator with a chi of Q and omega, which has the form that chi inverse has something like Q minus some big Q squared, plus an I omega over some characteristic time scale, rate, scattering rate. And this theory has a number of key predictions in three dimensions. And it's rather interesting to talk about three dimensions because, in fact, if you want to discuss the critical dimensionalities of this theory, because length scales come in with a power 2 compared to frequency, compared to time scales here, in this system the temporal correlation time at a quantum critical point should scale like the correlation length squared, okay, as you approach a quantum critical point. Consequently, when you deal with the scaling theory of this system and write down a Lagrangian for the interacting modes, the interacting spin fluctuation modes, you're dealing with a system which has an effective dimensionality which is equal to the spatial dimensionality plus z, where z is equal to 2. Okay. Now, if the relevant critical theory for these interacting modes is a phi to the fourth theory, this means that when we set this d to be the upper critical dimension for this theory, equal to, all of this has to be equal to 4, this then means that the upper critical dimension is equal to 2. So, that being the case, in a Millis-Hertz theory, if you're in a dimensionality above 2, this means that the long wavelength spin fluctuation modes will not interact strongly at long distances. Consequently, you're basically dealing with a mean field theory, and in particular, you won't observe the phenomenon of hyperscaling. You won't see that the spin correlation time is the only time scale in the problem. Only in dimensions 2 and lower do you expect in this theory to see hyperscaling. And so one of the relevant questions that then emerges is that, for example, if you have the susceptibility in this system at the critical Q, if you were at a dimension less than the upper critical dimension, then you'd expect this to exhibit exhibit hyperscaling, and the only scale in the problem, you basically have something like tau to some power times a function of omega times tau. And if you were below the upper critical dimension at a quantum critical point, since tau inverse goes like the temperature, this would then lead to a situation in which chi of q went like the energy or the temperature to minus alpha times a function of E over T. And so in this picture, we expect no E over T scaling for D equal to 3, and we'll just begin to see E over T scaling in D equals 2. And so scaling should not be a feature of a three-dimensional quantum critical point. Another aspect of a three-dimensional quantum critical point is that it doesn't predict a divergence of the effective mass at the quantum critical point. Just to remind you, some of the key features of such a system, basically what you will have is hot lines where the scattering is strong. These are the three-dimensional counterpart of the hot spots in two dimensions. And in the vicinity of the hot lines, you do have singular scattering. And in 3D, the scattering rate is proportional to the temperature at the hot along the hot lines. But the width of the hot line is, broadly speaking, proportional to the square root of the temperature. And so there's only a very small region of phase space where you have strong singular scattering. And the upshot of this is that the upshot of this is that in D equals 3, the specific heat capacity divided by temperature should equal a constant minus something times the square root of the temperature, and should not diverge. The effective mass, the average effective mass, remains finite at the quantum critical point. Only in D equals 2 do you expect a log of the temperature behavior. So one of the questions that emerges in asking whether the standard model applies to the quantum critical point of anti-ferromagnets in three dimensions is, do you see scaling? Do you see gamma remain finite, or does it tend to diverge at the quantum critical point? These are experimentally motivated questions, and on my other list, I'll come back to the issue of Fermi surface geometry, because that's an open question. Now, what I was going to do then is just very quickly show you some of the data that I think has already appeared at this meeting in the talk by Catherine Pepin. Just to remind you, of course, what's in the context of higher dimensional systems, one area that's been extensively studied is the area of heavy fermion systems. And these are systems of particular interest because by tuning the pressure, you can drive them to an anti-ferromagnetic quantum critical point. And here are two examples, although the list is actually growing. Let me take it out of the picture. No, it's not going to come.
That's all right, we can see it.
Fine. Okay. Cerium copper 6 gold, a system in which you can dope gold extremely homogeneously into the system and drive it into an anti-ferromagnetic state by the time you add 0.1% gold onto the copper side. And this is to date the only system in which the anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations have been studied extensively at the quantum critical point in a single crystal. Here's another system, cerium palladium to silicon 2, and closely related material cerium nickel 2, germanium 2. And these have the property that when you squeeze on them, they become more paramagnetic. Cerium palladium 2, silicon 2, around 30 kilobar, becomes, the axis here is pressure, by the way, becomes a paramagnet, and there's some superconductivity that develops at this particular point here. Cerium nickel 2, germanium 2 actually sits somewhere around here, and as you put pressure on it, you kill the superconductivity, and later at a still higher pressure, you develop superconductivity. This is the data of Marta Grosch and Lonsrich's group.
And the first one on top, I'm supposed to think of it as chemical pressure, or
Well, you can think of this as, you can think of X as negative pressure, okay? Because the what the gold does is to expand the lattice, basically. Okay. So one of the features that appears to develop at the quantum critical point is the appearance of a quasi-linear resistivity. Okay? In this particular example, it's T to the 1.2. And I can show you a number of other marvelous examples of this. As you go beyond the quantum critical point at very low temperatures, it does appear that a T squared resistivity redevelops. So though the data on that is a little bit less well developed.
Just taking us direction.
Yes, of course.
Have you thought about this? One of the things that Poincaré always says is that if you go away from the critical point with magnetic field, you get back T squared very rapidly,
yes.
Whereas if you go away with pressure, it's very hard to get back T squared.
Well,
is that something you thought
yes,
about?
Yes, well, I think one should have a little bit of doubt about that statement, in fact, because more recent data on serum nickel 2 germanium 2 does actually show a T squared resistivity developing at lower temperatures once you get beyond this critical region here. Mm-hmm. So then it's a question of, it is true, however, that turning on a magnetic field does, in fact, get you to the T squared behavior, enhances the crossover temperature as you go down. There does indeed appear to be a crossover temperature here.
In that region where it's roughly linear, mm-hmm. how high in temperature can you go such as
let me show you some examples now. Okay. Here is the same system. Well, I'll do my best to take it out.
We can see it.
Okay, fine. Okay.
But there's only a crossover.
Right?
Yeah. There's always a crossover from T squared to
Well, actually, that wasn't evident until very recently, okay? It's taken some very careful data to see a T-squared crossover away from the quantum critical point. In fact, just to show you, these are two examples at the quantum critical point here, okay? And here is serum nickel 2, germanium 2 away from the quantum critical point, and this still shows something that looks vaguely T to the 1.2. This is earlier data. More careful analysis of the derivatives of this and more careful measurements at low temperatures now reveal a T-squared regime in the data at low temperatures. Okay. So this seems to suggest that there is a crossover scale which is vanishing as you approach the quantum critical point. Yeah. Now, were that to be the case, you would have to worry about whether this were a three-dimensional system or not. If it were truly three-dimensional, that would then be a violation of what's expected in the standard model. Of course, one of the fallbacks you have is to say that perhaps the spin fluctuations are quasi-two-dimensional. And that tends to be one of the fallback explanations that people offer at the current time.
I'm sorry, how high temperature?
Sorry. Catherine was first.
I was just wondering how high in temperature.
In this particular case, it's only going up to 8 Kelvin. I believe that you can actually see this up to about 40 Kelvin in the cerium, palladium 2, silicon 2, and then it probably doesn't set, tends to curve over. Okay. Here's another example. In fact, there's.
What's rho naught?
What is rho naught?
I mean, how big is rho naught?
I can't answer that question offhand.
So I don't know whether this linearity is...
Oh, these are materials with resistance ratios of 200.
Yeah, but this is one micron centimeter, so that by itself doesn't help me.
That's right. So I think it's better to look at this material. This is an example of what I believe will be a growing list of ytterbium heavy fermion systems that can be driven to the quantum critical point. Turns out that ytterbium has the property that under ambient pressure, most of them are mixed valent. By squeezing on the system, you can actually drive it first to the Condor regime and then into an antiferro magnet. It turns out that typically this requires diamond anvil pressures, and people have some examples of this. But ytterbium, rhodium 2, silicon 2 actually sits almost exactly on the quantum critical point. It's a Condor system with an ambient, without any germanium, it has a transition temperature of something in the millikelvin range, 30 millikelvin. So a tiny amount of germanium pushes it back to the antiferromagnetic quantum critical point. And at that point, here you see a beautiful linear resistivity, which actually goes from 10 Kelvin all the way down to 0.05 Kelvin. Okay? Quite a nice example of linear resistivity. And bearing in mind that in the cerium, palladium 2, silicon 2, as you improve the resistance ratio, the exponent seems to come down closer to one, it makes one wonder whether in fact linearity might not be the property of the quantum critical point.
What's the
resistance ratio? I'm on the web, otherwise I would say something else. resistance ratio is the ratio of the resistivity at room temperature to the resistivity at zero temperature. And it's usually used as a method of characterizing how good a sample is. So a resistance ratio of 100 or even 1,000 is usually regarded as a very good material. Of course, it's only a crude measure of that. Now, if you see this unusual behavior at the quantum critical point, this then raises the question, well, what happens to the thermodynamics? And in quite a large range of materials, you see a logarithmic specific heat developing at the quantum critical point. And here is C over T versus temperature showing a logarithmic behavior in cerium, copper, 6-gold. And in this case, if you overdope it with gold, you can then see the antiferromagnetic transition here. And what's interesting is that as you now put pressure on it, you can drive it back down to the quantum critical point where you see exactly the same log T behavior. If you then go to smaller concentrations of gold, you can actually reach a region where it doesn't show up very nicely here, but there are samples where there's actually a crossover to a linear resistivity at a much lower temperature. Again, suggesting that as you approach the critical point, there is a crossover scale, a Fermi scale, which is going to zero. Now, in the case of cerium, copper, 6-gold, the spin fluctuations do have a quasi two-dimensional feature. And again, you can ask, well, is this because it just happens to have got itself into a frustrated state, which behaves in a quasi two-dimensional fashion, even though the conductivity is highly isotropic in this material. Here are two other examples. A material studied by Pedro Estrella in his thesis that's just come out this year. Again, you see a log behavior over a range of little less than two decades here. And finally, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon, you see a log behavior but an upturn at low temperatures. And at the current time, the experimentalists in Dresden who have done this measurement claim this is actually an intrinsic property of the material. Something still to be looked at. This could be due to inhomogeneities. It's probably not due to nuclear magnetism. So these data seem to suggest, although it's an open question, that there is a scale which diverges at the quantum critical point, and it can't be that all of these systems are quasi two-dimensional. In fact, one might doubt whether any of them are. So lastly, I wanted to come to the issue of scaling. And very, very briefly, we don't know the answer to the question whether they're scaling. One of the things that people have looked at is the inverse, the susceptibility at the uniform susceptibility. Now, in a in the standard model, you have critical scattering at an anomalous Q vector, but you don't expect that same critical behavior to be manifested at Q equals zero, which is very, very far away from the critical wave vector. And yet, surprisingly, what's seen is chi's with typically an upward curvature, which is intermediate between true Pauli susceptibility and a Fermi liquid behavior. In other words, some exponent that is less than one, typically. Perhaps the nicest example of this is cerium copper 6-gold, in which the chi inverse can be fitted to T to the 0.75. And not only does the uniform susceptibility show the same exponent, but as far as the data can be followed out into Q space, the very same behavior is seen at each point in Q space. Namely, chi inverse goes like T to the alpha plus a constant. This very same mysterious exponent, Chimiao will actually have some thoughts to talk about in his talk about how one might extract that from putative theory, but let me just show you some other appearance of this same exponent in the neutron scattering data obtained by Schroeder et al. At the critical wave vector. S here is the neutron scattering intensity, which has now been plotted times T to the 0.75, and then there's a whole bunch of data obtained in the region of the critical scattering, showing that actually this very same data can be plotted on an E over T scaling plot with, in fact, this exponent T to the 0.75. This is an indication that you can replace temperature by the energy, when you go to scales in energy which are larger than temperature. The other very mysterious feature of this material is the fact that actually, if you look at the differential susceptibility at Q equals zero, it exhibits H over T scaling with, once again, the same exponent, T to the 0.75. No one has an accepted explanation of this phenomenon at the moment. I should note that you can't explain this with disorder, because the size of the moment coming out of this fit here is roughly one Bohr magneton. So we have a picture here of local moments which are somewhat critically correlated in time, homogeneously throughout the lattice. This has motivated dynamical mean field studies of the phenomenon, which Chimiao will talk about momentarily.
It doesn't order at all.
This is at the critical mm-hmm. concentration.
But wait. So, you're saying that at any fixed field, I get a power law divergence as T goes to zero.
No, I'm not saying that. And to clarify what chi zero is, it's not. Let me define it very carefully. This is really the differential susceptibility that's been.
It's the
M by
the
H. I'll write it down here. Hang on. Just. So chi is the m by the h. So the way this is extracted is in the following procedure. Chi inverse is then defined as dh by the m, and what was plotted there was chi nor inverse. Well, it shouldn't have been the corrected chi. Differential chi was then dh by dm minus dh by dm at h equals zero. That was what was plotted there. Okay. In other words, it was really examining the possibility that chi inverse, defined as a differential susceptibility, is equal to a constant plus t to the alpha in terms of function of h over t. Okay, that's what's really been explored in that plot there.
Right. But even so, that power law is therefore argued to persist. I agree it's a sub-leading power law, but it's argued to persist over a wide range of ages.
Well, over the range that was measured.
Right, and therefore the interpretation that I should take away from this is that I have a critical law. I fix whatever, I have a whole range of fields for which this is critical. Is that the explanation of this?
I don't know. I would say that temperature cuts off. Temperature and field are interchangeable in the correlation functions. In other words, the scaling dimension in which H comes into the problem is the same as the scaling dimension as temperature. Okay. Right. So clearly, just as temperature takes you away from the critical point, so H takes you away from the critical point. What's unusual is the fact that as you go away from the critical point, you're seeing the same exponent in these different plots here.
Okay. So the special thing was the system was solved magnetically on a line in the Brillouin zone.
Well, now that's something which I haven't had time to talk about. This system actually is soft magnetically over a kind of line or actually butterfly-shaped region in momentum space. And the detailed Q dependence around that, whether it's Q squared in one direction and Q to the fourth in another direction, or completely flat in another direction, cannot be resolved at the moment. But it does have a feature. The scattering is strong in a region of momentum space that looks like this, and so there's strong momentum dependence going this way, but very weak momentum dependence going along this way. And these properties have been measured at different points on the butterfly-shaped critical region. So these really are questions that arise in the context of the standard model. And I just wanted to remind you, in ending this discussion, that actually there are in fact two competing pictures as to the way we regard the potential for a magnetic instability in these systems. And one is really the quantum spin density wave picture of the Standard Model, and this has its ancestry in ideas of Slater, Stoner, and Overhauser. It's the idea that you have some Fermi surface instability at a critical value of the magnetic coupling at a certain Q vector, which can occur even if the Fermi surface isn't nested, if you have strong enough coupling there. In such a picture, the Fermi surface geometry changes smoothly as you go through the quantum critical point. There's a competing picture which has its ancestry basically in the ideas of local moment formation and Doniak's picture of the Condor lattice, in which as you increase the size of the local coupling between the local moments and the conduction electrons, you gradually reach a regime where ultimately the spin fluctuations become large enough to destroy the antiferromagnetism and a Condor effect takes place. Now in such a picture, the Fermi surface then counts both the electrons and the spins, and there's a very nice proof due to Oshikawa using the Leibschutz-Matisse approach that in fact in a Condor lattice which doesn't develop long-range order, this Fermi surface sum rule will hold if there's a Fermi liquid present in higher dimensions. Now, the point is that now this means that the Fermi surface geometry changes as you go from this side to this side, and one of the questions you can ask is, well, do local moments, so here's a plot of two scenarios. In scenario one, the local moments quench at some finite temperature, and below that temperature scale, you have no local moments present. You have a purely itinerant picture. In that picture, this instability is then a spin density wave instability, and the Fermi surface geometry will not change suddenly at the quantum critical point. Okay. By contrast, in the second picture, it's conceivable, and I say only conceivable, but if there's a crossover scale, which could be the renormalized Condor scale or renormalized Fermi temperature, which goes to zero at the quantum critical point, revealing critically quenched local moments in this region, but then as you cross through here, you might conceivably have a sudden change in the Fermi surface geometry. Right down here, typically, you have an opposite sign for the Hall constant. Here, if you have an electron Hall constant, here, in the simplest model, you have a Hall-based Hall constant with a large Fermi surface. So it's possible that if you were to actually see a jump in the Hall constant at the quantum critical point, you could actually verify which of these pictures was actually being observed. Although I must say that the scaling properties and the chi-inverse behaving in this unusual way seems to suggest this kind of local picture. Now, just to end, I wanted, and whet your appetite, I wanted to just briefly bring your attention to a material which I heard about just a few weeks ago, a material which has been studied by the Hungarian and Swiss science community, and this is barium vanadate. And this comes to my question, what happens at a zero-temperature insulator metal quantum critical point in higher dimensions? This is a very interesting material which seems to have some overlap with some of the discussions we've had in the last week or two. Barium vanadium sulfide is a material which has been known for more than 10 years, but only recently was it possible for Faro et al. To grow single crystals of this material. And it has the following interesting properties. As you cool it at ambient pressure, the resistivity starts to rise at some crossover temperature scale, and then, in fact, at some slightly lower temperature, undergoes a metal insulator transition into an insulating phase, which initially shows no long-range antiferromagnetic order. When you cool it down to about 40 degrees Kelvin, they now know it develops long-range antiferromagnetic order. This sharp line here is the metal insulator transition, and the way they've defined it is by plotting the logarithmic derivative of the resistivity with respect to temperature as a function of temperature, and at the phase transition here, you see these marvelous spikes in the logarithmic derivative of the resistivity. That's how they defined this transition line here. This line here is defined as the minimum of the resistivity. And one of the interesting features of this material is that in between the minimum of the resistivity and this metal insulator transition along this line, you see a T, an unusual power law in the resistivity. Right? Now, when you pressurize it to 20 kilobar, what happens is that this system develops, hits a quantum critical point. And beyond that point, it's a power magnet, which is a metallic down to the lowest temperatures. And they don't yet know where the antiferromagnetism ends in this material, whether it ends at this point here or whether it ends at some earlier point here. Of course, that would be very interesting in the context of high-temperature superconductivity if indeed the antiferromagnetism disappeared before the metal insulator transition. But even if it disappears at the same time, this is a very nice example of a three-dimensional quantum critical point with a metal insulator transition.
But it could disappear after also, presumably.
It could, I suppose.
But
so.
Is
yes.
That transition from the resistivity data, that transition at lower pressures looks very first order. So
well,
why should I be using the second order language here? I mean, those resistivities just you know, they have a right angle of them. That looks first order to me.
This transition here?
Yeah.
What?
How can you say that? What is this graph up here on the right? Isn't that some critical?
Well, this is in the region here. This is in the region here.
As you approach the line.
Well, I think one of the things they could tell would be, for example, I don't think they see any sudden jumps in the volume as they go through the transition. No volume anomalies there. And so the experimentalists believe it to be second order.
Well, wait, is the resistivity itself continuous through the transition?
Okay. There, it's on a log scale, it makes a sharp right angle. That's the upper left curve.
The resistance is continuous. Beyond the point where the resistivity becomes finite. And they label it as non-Fermi liquid for the reason that resistivity has this unusual exponent, again, quasi-linear. In this case, they can fit it over this range with a T to the power of 1.25. So, and you can see that there's only a very small residual resistivity here. Comes in with this unusual behavior, which I suppose is clear the motivation for wondering whether it's a quantum critical point there. Yeah? Presumably, if it were a first order transition, you would recover a nice T squared behavior at higher temperatures. So anyway, I just wanted to draw your attention to this. And just going back to my list, I think that one of the reasons for asking these questions in the context of high temperature superconductivity is that if indeed it were to be shown that at these quantum critical points, the standard model breaks down, that indeed you have a non-trivial quantum critical point in three dimensions, then it would raise the question that of what is the nature of the quantum critical theory that gives rise to an upper critical dimension greater than or equal to 3. And if such a theory were to exist, then surely it would be interesting in two dimensions. So I'll end at that point. Yep.
Any further questions? Otherwise, we should probably move on.
I'll be discussing much of the similar issues Pierce did, basically on the quantum critical points in the heavy fermion metals, and in the process try to draw some general lessons which might be of relevance to some other strongly correlated electron systems, strongly correlated metals as well. And this work done in collaboration with my postdoc Silvio Radillo and a student Lorraine Smith Rice, and also with Kevin Ingerson, at the University of Florida. Just to set my notations, this is a schematic phase diagram that you've already seen from Pierce, that we have now a bunch of heavy fermion metals where by tuning, by tuning some parameter delta, one can change from a paramagnetic phase, paramagnetic metal, to an anti-ferromagnetic metal. And in some cases, there's superconductivity happening at low temperatures. In others, there's not. And genetically, there's non-firm liquid properties showing up in this quantum critical regime. And these are reasonably carefully studied to be continuous transition that's taking place. And examples we've already heard from Pierce. And the typical example that experimentalists would use to identify the non-firm liquid behavior would be to see that resistivity is enormous, and in some cases, as we heard, there could be like 3 decades of linear temperature dependence in resistivity, and also thermodynamics could have enormous behavior, for instance, logarithmic temperature dependence of the specific heat coefficient. So, three examples Pierce has already shown that spare me from that. So basically, for people who have not necessarily worked on heavy fermion metals, we can basically microscopically think of that as a lattice of local moments in a conduction electron sea. So it's a typically three-dimensional crystal, and every side we can there are two kinds of degrees of freedom. There's local moment, which basically electron which is interacting very strongly with each other. These are f orbitals. And there's a conduction electron, and we're talking about metal, so for these systems, one local moment at every site, and on average, there's x electrons at every site, and x is different from 1, 2, or 3, or 4. And as we learned since a long time ago, that there are two energy scales in this problem, that one is that if there's one, if we consider the local moment by itself, it's merged in the conduction electron C, so there's a Kondo energy scale T Kondo 0, which is exponentially small in terms of the Kondo coupling, and there's, then if one considers two local moments, there's the RKKY coupling, which perturbatively is J Kondo square. And again, just to set up for later references, as we already heard from Pierce, that there's a standout picture, which sort of goes back to the time of 70s of the work of Doniak and others, although Doniak didn't exactly say these things, but over the years accumulated as a standout picture. Namely, that when the RKKY interaction between the local moments is small, then the Kondo process is basically quench all the local moments, and we end up with the Kondo resonance, which form together with the conduction electrons, the heavy quasi-particles, and these heavy quasi-particles have a Fermi surface which is large in the sense that it encloses both the local moments and the conduction electrons. And as we tune the parameter, which I used in delta in my one for earlier transparencies, that's like increasing the RKKY interaction, and the standard picture made us to believe that the transition is basically the spin density wave type of transition associated with the quasi-particles who live in the vicinity of the large Fermi surface. And that leads to an important consequence, namely that if we think about the quantum critical behavior in these heavy fermion metals, it would be essentially the same as quote-unquote ordinary metals undergoing an SDW transition, because local moments physics have already gone away. They have been completely quenched. And for later, as we heard from Pierce, there's a standard model which in the framework of the of a critical phenomenon was formulated by John Hertz, and in recent years systematic by Andy Millis. And basically, since we are talking about a spin density wave transition, we basically can write down a Ginsberg lambda type action for the fluctuations of the order parameter. So basically, we only need to deal with moment wave vector close to the ordering wave vector. But since this is a quantum critical, is a quantum phase transition, statics and dynamics mix up in determining universality class, so the effective dimension becomes d plus z, where z is the dynamical exponent, and that makes the system to be essentially above the or equal to the upper critical dimension. And there's an important consequence following that statement, one of them being that necessarily we'll have hot spots and cold regions on the Fermi surface, and second being that the dynamical spin susceptibility for a generic Q, for Q away from the ordering wave vector, would basically have RPA type form. So we expect the imaginary part of the susceptibility to be basically linear in frequency. This coefficient here is a smooth function of Q omega and T. And if we get wave vector closer to the ordering wave vector, we have a form where we, this factor determines the temperature dependence of the correlation length. And in the stable ordering wave vector, this is a singular susceptibility, and that singularity is supposed to be leading to the this non-firm liquid type of properties.
I just a bit historical. Yeah. It's true that Doniak pointed all these things out,
right?
But it's also true that in the late 80s, Doniak wanted to have a transition which was inconsistent with this, characterized somehow by, in mathematical language, a slave boson amplitude going to zero in peculiar local physics.
I see.
To my knowledge, he never really tried to push that idea hard, but there was about a year and a half when he was saying that.
Yeah, I can believe that. In fact, even if you go back to the 70s, to Doniak's work, it was also done for the essentially the kind of inserting concentration. So some of this is basically the law in the field, which derived from not exactly what was said. But that's the standard picture that has been associated.
All I'm trying to say is that this new exotic kind of transition, he wanted to do what he talked about.
I think it may, the only reference is the Bangalore conference.
Oh, it's a typical set, right? He talked about it in a number of places.
It's hard to get hold of, but I think he did use it then.
Okay. Well, fine. Yeah, if we're trying to finish the work which was outlined there, that would be fine too. Okay. So basically, there's a number of materials, but one which has been most carefully studied by the neutron scattering is in a cerium copper sixth orbit with gold, as we heard from Pierce. And it's sort of a natural thing to do. In heavy fermions, we cannot do photo emission, but the neutron is probing directly the critical fluctuations, and we want to see whether the expectations from the standard picture actually comes out. And so just not repeating what Pierre said, basically there are three features I want to emphasize here. The first is that, so this is work actually by Gabe Apley's group and also Hilbert von Lohneisen's group from Karlsruhe, and Pierce Coleman was actually involved in analysis of the experimental data. What came out was, first of all, that there's this enormous exponent. The frequency dependence is not linear. Instead, it has this interesting power law, enormous exponent 0.75, which also shows up in the temperature dependence. So at the ordering wave vector, this factor would go to zero, and one actually has this omega over t scaling that follows from this expression. And secondly, this expression seems to be working for essentially the entire Brillouin zone that have been looked at, including Q equals zero, where one can do very systematic studies. And so that suggests that there's something local that is anomalous in a quantum critical regime. And finally, for this particular system, neutron seems to be showing that the peaks are happening not at isolated points in a three-dimensional Brillouin zone, but along some lines or this butterfly structure, which then would translate into the quasi-two-dimensional type of structure in real space in the magnetic fluctuations. So whether this quasi-2D type feature first of all, experiment whether with finer resolutions, whether this persists, that obviously need to be checked, and whether how generic these quasi 2D fluctuation to other heavy fermions which show these singular properties also need to be studied by neutron scattering. But nonetheless, this has motivated us to look at this problem microscopically and...
Yes? So I understand the implication that we draw from the data is that this butterfly structure corresponds to structure in the static F of Q. I'm just asking about the relation between parts A and B.
That's right,
the butterfly structure in F of Q, which is
F of Q would be going to zero. The implication is F of Q is going to zero.
It's only F of Q, and the A part is independent of Q and doesn't care whether you're on this butterfly or not.
More or less, yes.
Okay,
yeah. So the question that we address is basically, is there more than one type of quantum critical points in Condor lattices, and briefly describe the methodology, because that's in this field, that's part of the important ingredient. And the result is basically that there is the SDW transition that can happen in these Condor lattices under certain conditions, and under other conditions, there's a more interesting, what I call the locally critical quantum phase transition that can take place in these Condor lattice systems. And there's parallel work that Pierce Coleman, Catherine Pepin, and others who are carrying out using different methodology, which I understood Catherine Pepin talked about in this program earlier. So let me just very briefly outline the way we treat the problem. So this is a slight extension of the standard dynamical mean field theory, which I assume many people have at least heard of. And the extension is that in the usual dynamical mean field theory, one treats the local fluctuations in local interactions in dynamical fashion, but treating the non-local interactions in a static using static treatment essentially. And here, basically, we treat both types of interactions in a dynamical fashion. So that for the Condor lattice, there's a dynamical competition between the Condor processes and the RKKY processes. And so basically, we start from, as I said earlier, a lattice system where every side is a local moment, and there's a conduction electron orbital, which and between different sides, there's coupling at the single electron hopping level. And here, for technical reasons, when we also introduce explicit RKKY interaction, that we make sure that there's no double counting between the explicit RKKY interaction and the induced RKKY interactions. And one goes through this dynamical mean field procedure, which basically look at this lattice problem by an effective local problem. And in this extension, what the added ingredient is that in this local problem, the local moment is not only coupled to a fermionic bath, but also to a vector boson or a fluctuating magnetic field bath. And this fluctuating magnetic field basically reflects the physics that if I'm on the parallel magnetic side and look at this local moment, this through the RKKY coupling, this rest of local moments, I pick up a field from the magnetization due to the local moments at all the other sides, and since everybody's fluctuating, that's a fluctuating magnetic field. And one can write down at the Hamiltonian level, which what I just described in terms of the picture, namely, we have the usual Condor coupling of this effective local moment to the spins of the conduction electron bath or the fermion bath, and also an additional coupling of this local moment to these phi. Phis are the fluctuating magnetic field with the dispersion W of K. And all these parameters will have to be determined self-consistently. So that's the local way of looking at this Condor lattice. And through this procedure, we hope to basically treat the local physics in a more systematic fashion and see what comes out of that. And so let me just mention briefly about what the self-consistency conditions are. And so from that effective local problem which I just described, one can calculate the properties like electron self-energy and the what I call the spin self-energy, which there's a more technical word for that related to the some cumulant, etc. But that for this discussion, that serves the purpose. And as in any dynamical mean field theory, there's no momentum dependence in these irreducible quantities. And the spin self-energy is coming in a lattice stability through this form, where chi of q omega is 1 over m omega plus iq, where I of q is basically the Fourier transform of the starting RKKY interaction in a real space. And so what I want to draw is a contrast to the usual RPA treatment, where one would also have this sort of form for the lattice spin susceptibility, but this spin self-energy would essentially be related to the particle hole bubble of the quasi-particles. Here, so there's an explicit statement that this imaginary part of this will have to be linear in omega. That's put in the RPA treatment. Here, we ask what the self-consistent solution tells us, whether it's linear in omega or not, and that will reflect different physics. And the self-consistent basically is a statement of translation invariance that if we average over the single particle Green's function in a lattice problem, that should give us the local Green's function. And if we average over the lattice spin susceptibility, it should be equal to the local susceptibility. So that's, I don't want to get into too much details of that, but that's sort of a basic picture of this extended dynamical mean field theory. And for people who are more, there's also a formulation in terms of diagrammatic form once, and that we did and published earlier this year in a Physical Review B paper. But what I want to do next is just see what comes out of this dynamical mean field analysis. So to see the results, let me just first say that within this formulation, there are two effects that the RKKY interaction induces. And so basically, as the tuning parameter delta, which can be connected to the tuning parameter that I drew in the very first or second transparency, which can be taken as a ratio of the effective RKKY interaction over the Kondo energy scale. As the RKKY interaction increases, there are two things that's happening. One is that on general grounds, we expect the susceptibility at the peak wave vector will be increasing as the RKKY interaction increases. So and we expect that this susceptibility at omega 0 will diverge as this parameter reaches certain threshold value. And that's the point where the whole ladder system will be undergoing a magnetic transition. But on top of that, from this local point of view, there's also the change of the local dynamics that's induced by the RKKY interaction. Namely, that if we look at this effective local problem with the coupling to the fermion bath and the fluctuating magnetic field induced by the rest of the local moments, this coupling constant G will also be increasing as the RKKY interaction is changing. So this change to local dynamics is the new ingredient that the dynamical mean field way of looking at the Kondo lattice would contrast with the, for instance, the RPA way of looking at Kondo lattice. And to see what kind of new physics that can comes in through this change of the local dynamics, one can first look at a not precisely self-consistent problem, but that teaches us something about what can happen to the local dynamics as this local coupling G with the fluctuating magnetic field is increasing. Namely, we put in a particular dispersion of the of this phi, or a particular spectral form of the fluctuating magnetic field, and this is prescribed by this expression here, where when gamma less than 1, that's correspond to the subohmic form in the dissipative like Kaldera-Leggett type of problem notation. And what we found that in this case, this local problem itself has a quantum critical point of its own as the ratio G over T condo 0 is varying. And namely, when this coupling is small enough, the condo process ones, so here the local moments is completely quenched for this effective impedance problem. But when we increase this coupling large enough, this coupling to the fluctuating magnetic field is a process which competes against the condo quenching process. The fluctuating magnetic field wants to polarize the local moment along its direction, which prevents the condo screening of the local moment from happening. And if the the fluctuation of this effective this field is slow enough, it can actually compete against the condo quenching process. And slow enough is prescribed by this gamma less than 1 requirement. So this is a work that that a couple of years ago we did, and also independently by done by Sengupta. And the upshot is that at this critical point of the local problem, as we approach it from the left, the local susceptibility will become divergent, or related to that, there's a critical slowing down of this local phenomena, so there's some local energy scale which goes to zero, which can be effectively thought of as an effective Fermi energy of this problem, because that's a scale below which the dynamical space susceptibility will become linear in frequency, the imaginary part of that. So at this stage, there are two questions one has to ask. First of all, can this local criticality coincide with the magnetic orderly transition? As I said, RKKY interaction was inducing two things. One is leading to this criticality associated with the local problem, and the other is leading to the magnetic transition of the entire orderly transition of the entire lattice. And second, related question is, what is the origin of this subohmic spectrum, or this gamma less than 1 that was put in the previous transparency to begin with for the fluctuating magnetic field? And we found that basically the answers to both of these questions lie in the self-consistency. And once one imposes the self-consistency, we found that two kinds of solutions for the quantum critical the critical point can emerge. And the condition that separates these two kind of solutions within this extended dynamical mean field approach is dependent on quantity that's called RKKY density. How much time should I proceed without?
About 7 minutes.
Okay.
This gamma is something you just put in by hand?
Up to this point, I've put in by hand and demand that it's less than 1. But I'll answer where it comes from. In the self-consistency solution. And the RKKY density, let me not go into too much detail, but the definition is basically that just like we would define a density of states for a single electron dispersion epsilon k, we can define an equivalent quantity for the RKKY interactions. And this within the extended dynamical mean field theory, different forms of the RKKY density state would reflect different kinds of dimensionality of the underlying speed factor, which is related to the question you asked earlier about what FQ was doing.
The point that for Fermi
Envelope,
problem, I have a band and I have a Pauli principle,
sure.
So I have to fill up the band
sure.
somewhere in the middle. These things are presumably...
This is a mathematical quantity, which doesn't have... it does characterize what is...
My question, I guess, is everything interesting going to come from the bottom of the band?
Yeah, it will be at the edge.
Okay, so the crucial question is what form do you assume?
Precisely. So in 3D systems, you would expect a square root type answer, and in 2D systems, there will be a jump. And that's what will come in. And the reason it comes in is that you can rewrite the self-consistency equation I wrote down earlier by in terms of this RKKY density of our states. So with that, I can describe now two kinds of solutions, two kinds of self-consistent solutions that emerge. And the first type is the following. As I said earlier, if we just look at a local problem alone, we will have a, as we increase this parameter characterizing the strength of the RKKY interaction, the local problem has a chance to become critical. However, if the lattice system magnetic orders magnetically at a point prior to the point where we can reach the criticality of local problem, meaning that chi at this particular order of wave vector q at 1 equals 0 diverges at this point before we have a chance to reach this point, then this is the quantum critical point that we're talking about. And at this quantum critical point, this energy scale E local star is finite, which is essentially like saying that the effective Fermi energy is finite, or another way of saying the same thing, that the local moments are completely quenched. So the critical behavior then turns out to be identical to what I had ascribed to as the standard picture, that basically it's a SDW transition associated with these heavy quasi-particles whose volume is 1 plus x. And this occurs when we put in an RKKY density state which has a square root onset, and we can identify that with the 3D magnetic fluctuation structure. The second type of solution is as follows. As we increase this tuning parameter delta, the place where the lattice system as a whole orders magnetically, in fact, coincides with the place where this local problem becomes critical. So then this is the critical point, and the quantum critical regime would reflect the dynamics of this associated with this local criticality as well. So at the quantum critical point, in fact, this local energy scale vanishes, and the local fluctuations here would reflect basically some vestiges of local moments which remain. And this one can call it as a local, it's a critical point, it's a quantum phase transition where it is also locally critical. And there's a critical local degrees freedom that coexists with the spatially extended along wavelength fluctuations of the order parameter. And within this formulation, this occurs when there's a jump in this RKY density state at the edge, so that one identifies with the 2D magnetic fluctuations.
I'm sorry, why isn't this preempted by an instability in some particular Q? I mean, if I come down at zero temperature on the red side, usually even in this infinite dimensional formalism, there's some Q where the local susceptibility just from the fermions is bigger than the average. And so you would think that would sort of...
Which would then go back to the previous, the picture.
Which would generically preempt this.
Yeah, so what prevents that from happening is basically a jump at the... The jump is happening where this RKKY interaction in the Fourier after the Fourier transform is the most negative. Okay? And so...
I'm not sure I understand that, but are there...
What you describe is a genetic situation, which we were accustomed to.
Yeah. Within there, I should have an extra contribution, which I can think of, although I agree RK isn't exactly right, as a bubble of your fermions, which should be added on top. And that bubble of fermions has structure as a function of Q, even in this infinite dimensional approximation. Right. So it's that thing which would give you a susceptibility somewhere which is bigger than average, and you would think would just preempt this. That's what's bothering me.
Fine. I mean, the way you describe the RKKY interaction is how we treat them in standard dynamical quantum field theory. And that's that comes in basically as you are not treating the dynamics associated with the RKKY interactions, and then you put it in and later on ask what happens to the magnetism. Here, the way we treat them, to start with, both processes are treated dynamically. And it's a simple algebra actually to show that this can happen. Yeah. So at this point, at this locally critical point, one can in fact solve all the various properties I described earlier on. So local susceptibility comes out to be logarithmic with a dependence on lambda, which is some upper cutoff in energy, which is some combination of Lebesgue, Kondo energy, and RKKY interaction strength. And correspondingly, what I call the spin self energy turns out to have a form with a frequency dependence which has an enormous exponent, and this exponent turns out to be a non-universal value which depends on the value of the RKKY density state at the edge, and also this cutoff. Yes,
so, so how non-universal is it? Could it have literally any value, 3.5, 2.8, 1.9? I mean,
well, it's from 0 to 1.
So, yeah. But if it were greater than 1, would the procedure still work?
From if it's greater than 1, I would worry about it, because you would expect there's a cutoff which is due to some fermion background that must be there.
But formally, it's just a jump, so it can have any value, right?
Formally, it can have. So, I mean, what we are working very hard is to find existing proof of this locally critical type point, and this when alpha is between 0 and 1, that's a consistent solution. So, because we're not solving the problem exactly, right? The extended dynamical mean field theory is still treating it's an infinite summation of the usual.
Yes, I was asking, are there subconsistent solutions where alpha is greater than 1?
I would say if alpha comes out to be larger than 1, I wouldn't trust the result.
Yeah. But formally it works fine.
Formally, yeah, sure. And if you feed the spin self energy into the initial form of the Q-dependent susceptibility, it comes out with a form of this. If I take this as f of Q, this is precisely the form that we looked at from fitting of the neutron scattering data in cerium copper 6 gold at the critical concentration, where the data says it's alpha of 0.7.5. And at this level of sophistication, the fact that there's a jump in the RKKY density states at the edge, which is tied up to the occurrence of such a locally critical point, is consistent with the quasi-2D nature of the magnetic fluctuation that one actually sees in cerium copper gold. And it remains seen experimentally how general this tying up is.
I'm sorry. Suppose you didn't include the RKKY in the first place.
Yes.
In the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
You would induce it anyway by, I mean,
that's
the
right.
Conduction band.
Yeah.
So if you apply all this, then
not in large Dillon at this order.
Oh.
Yeah.
So
we're not. So that's why we're not double counting.
So you're saying effective RKKY goes down.
It's high order in one of the. That's right. Okay. And also, we can also work out the finite temperature version for this dynamical spin susceptibility at this locally critical point. And at the Q, that's equal, at the peak wave vector, this chi, the dynamical spin susceptibility does have omega over T scaling, which again, we've heard from Pierce that that's showing up in the neutron data in cerium copper 6 gold at a critical concentration. And also, the Q equals 0 of uniform and static spin susceptibility comes out to have this modified Curie-Weiss form with alpha, which is the same as is seen in the neutron result. And that, again, at this level, is consistent with the magnetization data in cerium copper 6. And even in some other heavy fermion metals near the critical point where one doesn't, where neutron hasn't been done, there's indications of this modified Curie-Weiss type of form for the uniform spin susceptibility, and those would be good candidates to look at whether there's enormous local dynamics that's happening. There's a question.
Yeah, why do you say that it's, there is still RKKY in infinite dimensions? You said that it drops out?
The RKKY interaction is of order of 1 over D.
But actually had a big problem constructing, avoiding, for example, magnetic states.
Right.
In this infinity approximation.
Right, right.
So where does those come from?
So this is one of the, this is a static component. That
so
at a special, component
that's drops out, you argue with
yeah.
The static component remains.
Right, so that static component then is not treated in a it doesn't come into dynamics, but you can put it in later on. That's the standard procedure that one does. Okay. And here we're treating basically through this extended dynamical mean field theory, we're treating both of them, both statically and dynamically. Now I want to basically, so that's from the point of view of understanding these neutron data in heavy fermions and in some other magnetization data in heavy fermions, this local criticality seems to be something which is which is very appealing. Now, we might also draw some broader implications of this local criticality for other strongly correlated metals. So if we go back to the Ginzburg-Landau description, yeah, the SDW transition, the effective field theory would be basically describing this fluctuations of the order parameter, or it basically depends on the effective magnetization at a Q close to the ordering wave vector, and also the time dependence of it. However, at the locally critical point, we have not only these spatially extended critical degrees of freedom, but there's also these locally critical degrees of freedom, which has to be also part of the field theory. And then on top of that, one of course has to mix the two. And in fact, this mixed term is crucial, so that when the local moments become critical, the magnetic ordering would also be taking place, and that allows us to in fact reach this critical point by tuning only one parameter, as opposed to demanding tuning two parameters. And that's what is needed for it to be of any relevance for most systems. So that's one important lesson which might be of broad interest. Yes.
Maybe I'm completely off here, but I mean, you would think of critical point and effective actions as usually long wavelengths.
Right.
So how local physics can actually.
So in classical phase transition, we grew up with this notion. In fact, the first thing we would do is to do coarse graining and
right,
go to
no
longer and a longer length scale. So and there that makes sense because we know universality class is only determined by statics. But if we go to a quantum critical point, statics and dynamics have to be mixed up in determining universality class.
But that doesn't change his criticism.
Sorry.
No, but that's just low energy. They're all low energy local degrees of freedom. Is that
one way to happen is for the quantum at the quantum critical point is you just introduce time fluctuations of the same.
That I understand.
Yeah, let me come to that. So the local object, the question is whether a local object can live at a low energy or not, even though it's not spatially extended. And in
what
fact,
saves it from being, I mean, you might think it might start out being local, but would then develop longer and longer correlation and become a non-local object in
right.
space. So what saves the locality? What protects the locality in the theory?
Well, I would say nothing prevents it from happening. I mean, if we go back to the Kondo problems and ask whether these local problems can have a critical point, and we know the answer is yes. So even though it's a completely spatially local object, it can still live at low energies.
Presumably, this is just because of the time dynamics.
Yeah, it's long ranged in time, but it's spatially local.
Right, but that's the curious thing. It's
right.
like no other transition, right? What you're saying is that it's long range in one of your x number
right.
of dimensions,
yeah.
and short range in all the others.
Right. But I mean, would we? The only real requirement is that these degrees of freedom have low energies, right? So we can have a long-range correlated thing in time, which is guaranteed to have low energy. Obviously, we cannot go the other way around if it's a spatially extended and high energy degrees.
The data is set, right? So,
that's right.
So we shouldn't call that data quantum critical either.
Right.
Why not?
Yeah. I mean, it's not your traditional
right. yeah.
critical point.
But surely you need something. I mean, I could add something to this theory which would make the excitation non-local,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to prove it were critical. Those terms would be irrelevant.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. Once one has field energy, then one can add all the terms and ask whether it's relevant or irrelevant, and this clearly that hasn't been done. And we've done the microscopic theory, and this is a field theory way of looking at local critical point. Much work needs to be done, that's clear. And so that's one point, to me, it could have broader implications. And the second is that lesser consequence of these locally critical degrees of freedom is that at a critical point, will not have cold regions on the Fermi surface, in the sense that they will, if we go back to the SDW picture, there's a fixed Q at which low energy degrees of freedom lives, so there will necessarily be hot spots and other regions where these Q cannot span, and that necessarily leads to T square damping. The presence of these local critical degrees of freedoms allows us to get all the Fermi surface to have a not T square or a non-Fermi liquid type damping rate. And from the point of view of what we are seeing in a photo emission in a Q plate, that seems to be a very interesting and important feature to come out. And finally, just make a very speculative point. We see this extended dynamical mean field solution. We can get to such a local critical point at all because, to begin with, there's already local moments that have been formed. Local moments are formed between high energy, the cooling energy scale, and the asymptotic low energy scales. And the question we have asked is really the fate to this interesting local degrees of freedom. And in SDW case, these local moments at low energies completely have gone. At a local critical point, it survives in some form, even though obviously susceptibility is not QE. But it's not Pauli as well. It's in fact has this logarithmic singularity. So obviously, this local, this interesting local physics at intermediate scales is something that in fact defines all the strongly correlated systems in the Mott-Hubbard systems we have. That's precisely how the Mott insulator comes about. And we might speculate whether this local physics can lead to something like a local critical point involved Mott insulators, in which case would have fundamental implications for the physics of cuprates or other strongly correlated metals. So let me just summarize. So we've carried out extended dynamical mean field analysis of the condor lattice, and this is a procedure which captures a dynamical competition between condor and RKKY interactions, and we found that there can be two types of quantum phase transitions, one of the usual SDW type, and another that is also locally critical, and this critical point has compares very well, in fact, with the neutral and the magnetization data in silicon copper 6 doped with gold at a critical concentration, as well as in some of the other heavy fermions where there's a magnetization data but no neutron data, and this may have some broader implications for other strongly correlated metals. Thanks very much.
Junya, let me pursue this point a little bit. So how should you think about it? Any Ginsburg lambda is basically one step beyond a mean field theory.
Mm-hmm.
You have a mean field something.
Static mean field theory, usually.
Static mean field theory. Okay. Even dynamical mean field theory, whatever. I mean, it means that you have something which disappears at one point.
Right.
And it's small, close to that point.
Right.
And you make an expansion in this, right? Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, you assume that it may be non-uniform.
Right.
So, but if something is local, then what does it mean? You work on a lattice in your effective description, or what? I mean, how do I think about it? How should I think about it? What's S local is in terms of how it's written in terms of what? I mean, what's the formula for S local?
Well, that's a much harder question. I mean, the closest one can think about is, in fact, a Mott transition. At zero temperature.
No, but is there a single diverging correlation length at that critical point?
No, he has no length. So we're trying to ask, for is there a single diverging correlation time? And he's showing you that there is.
Okay, time.
You have to have some length.
The length is there because
you're
there's the magnetic ordering, so the m of q omega the chi of q at a q cross for the ordering way back is becoming divergent. So there's a correlation length.
But yes. You've done something sneaky in defining the step in your density of states to be exactly where the RKKY interaction is maximal time. Space is somehow sneaked into your problem because that the lower bandage of your magnetic thing, which you start to populate,
within extended dynamical nucleus,
is supposed to occur at whatever the magic wave vector is where you're ordering.
Right. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, because your mean field dynamical material theory, essentially you've reduced the problem to a one-dimensional one. That's it. You're treating this impurity, so you've got just quantum time dimension that you're dealing with.
Well, that's half of a story. The other half is demanding self-consistency. So
sure, there is self-consistency, but
so that's just calculating local quantities.
But anyway, what I'm concerned about is this. I mean, we know from the theory of quasi-say one-dimensional systems that as soon as you turn on an arbitrarily small coupling between your one-dimensional chain, your chains are in the time direction.
Right.
But as soon as you turn on an arbitrarily small coupling between them, you run into a three-dimensional ordering.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether the same thing wouldn't happen here also. That's whether basically any type of non-locality beyond the dynamical nucleus theory would be relevant in the sense of introducing long-range order.
Well, I mean, this extension is already capturing some part of these inter-site effects associated with the RKKY interactions. You're asking, suppose we go beyond one side problem, say a dynamical cluster theory or some form, what happens? And obviously that's a hard question, and that at this stage it's not clear how to address that. So a more profitable way would be to try to construct this effective field theory having both these spatial extended and these locally critical degrees freedom, and ask, putting all the possible perturbations and see whether this fixed point is stable or not. And that's much more, that's presumably the way to address this question. I haven't addressed the effect of magnetic field.
What's the entropy? It's not extensive, but it must go with some high power.
No, at a zero temperature limit, there's no entropy, right? So that already differs from the usual critical point, usual non-ferromolecular phase in the local problem.